Hello and welcome to this edition of In Our Wedding Time, where we examine how Germany was unified. In 1815, there was no Germany. There were 39 sovereign states bound loosely together in a German confederation that existed largely to preserve the status quo. By 1871, there was a German empire proclaimed in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, with the Prussian king as its emperor and Otto von Bismarck, the architect of three wars, as its chancellor. The transformation of Central Europe in barely half a century is one of the great stories of modern history. It is a story driven by ideas, economics, diplomacy, and brute military force, with consequences that reverberate into the 20th century. It begins with the cultural nationalism of the early 19th century and gathers pace with the Zollverein, the Prussian-led customs union established in 1834, and that knits the German states together economically, and it gives Prussia a quiet but decisive advantage over its Habsburg rival, Austria. It erupts in the revolutions of 1848, when liberals and radicals attempt to build a unified constitutional Germany from below through the Frankfurt Parliament, only to be thwarted by their own divisions, the resilience of the old order, and the refusal of the Prussian king to accept what he called a crown from the gutter. The failure of 1848 set the stage for a very different kind of unification, one driven not by parliamentary debate, but by what Bismarck famously called iron and blood. As minister-president of Prussia from 1862, Bismarck pursued a strategy of realpolitik. He isolated Austria diplomatically, destroyed her at the Battle of Sadowa in 1866. He manipulated the Hohenzollern candidature crisis and the Ems telegram to provoke Napoleon III's France into a war that ended with the capture of the French emperor at Sedan. And he used the wave of patriotic fervour to persuade the reluctant southern German states to join a new empire under Prussian leadership. Joining me in the studio today to get to grips with the questions that really matter are Mr. Smith.
Hello.
And Mr. Gutteridge.
Hello.
Okay, so let's turn to the origins, as it were, of German nationalism. And I think it's a good place to start. Was the Wormers really the time when nothing happened, or were there significant foundations being laid?
There were some foundations being laid. Certainly the idea of nationalism and liberalism, but nationalism in particular. The German states, even though they were in this loose confederation, did have similar heritage and language and sort of cultural affinity. And they... sort of some middle class liberal sort of thinkers did seem to say, perhaps we are better together than apart. And the experience of the Napoleonic Wars as well, there was an anti-French sentiment created by that. We got a shared sense of resistance against Napoleon. And of course, they won, or we won. Remember Blücher arriving at the Battle of Waterloo. He was a German after all, Prussian. And so they did have this binding together. And out of that was the German Confederation with, and Prussia grew in size in what we now know as sort of Germany and Austria and the Austrian Empire. But there were also some events where nationalism was allowed to grow, and the Wartburg Festival in particular, but also, and also the Hamburg Festival. And we had perhaps thousands of mainly students would meet up and debate these things and say, we would be better together. And however, you asked Mr. Joy about, did much happen? Was this strong foundations? And I'm inclined to say these were pretty shaky foundations. They have now this notion that maybe we are proud people, we should work together. But really, that was it. The governments were still very much in charge with their 6 articles, 10 articles, the Carlsbad decrees. All these sort of squashed any very embryonic sort of nationalist fervour that was going on. So really a very quiet time. It really needed something else to stimulate that sort of sense of unity and desire to change how Germany was.
Can I come in and challenge that as a sort of interpretation or portrayal? I think a lot of significance is happening here in terms of I think you're right in terms of the concrete stuff we can point to and be like, autocratic powers are still in place. There is no unified Germany yet. But so many of the things that come to mean Germany later on really rise to prominence in this time. If you think about things like the German flag, the tricolour, the black, red, gold, you know, that is being waved at the Hambach Festival by thousands of people. There is this, I think, this sense of identity which is needed. It's a prerequisite for the later nationalist ideal and nationalist project that I think is really important. And then also, if we can move on to the Solferine, I don't know if we're jumping ahead a little bit there, but that's happening in this period that we're talking about, the Vormärz period. So we'll perhaps unpack that a little bit more later. But I think, you know, there are a lot of events happening, and I think we tend towards saying nothing happened because it's not concrete, but it is so important and fundamental to German identity.
Okay, well, thank you. So I think we have the idea of the sort of the birth of the sort of idea of nationalism, but put into effect largely by students. But then the way in which the authorities then clamp down on that, that's very repressive, very, very strong indeed. But the idea remains. I think we can now move on to think about economic developments. And at the center of that is the Zollverein itself. So in terms of the Zollverein, is it the case that economic integration made political unification inevitable? Or did it need something else? Is the Zollverein good enough, as it were, to actually provide us with integration that isn't just economics, also distinctly political?
I think it's interesting you use the term inevitable there. I would say no. In history, particularly if we're looking at these things sort of, the Zollverein is founded in 1834. We're not going to see the proclamation of Germany for another 37 years. So to draw out an inevitable causation from that, I think would be too much. But I think your wider point is spot on, that the Zollverein, it's an economic union. So what it is, it's a customs union led by Prussia, which basically means within the states who join it, there are no internal tariffs and goods can move around, but they have an agreed sort of set import tax for anything from without. And if you look at it in this Vormärz period, so the period up until March 1848, we see growth. So 1834, we've got 18 states, 1836, seven more join, we've got 26 million people in it. And by 1844, we only have really the big power of Austria and then the Hanseatic towns who have this history of free trade on the Baltic and the North Sea outside it. So in that sense, we have a very powerful economic bloc. But I think it ties very clearly across to the things we were mentioning earlier, where Mr. Guttridge is talking about a sense of German identity formed in the Battle of Leipzig and against Napoleon and the French. There is a manifestation through which national identity can begin to be seen. You can look at that, and it's enhancing this feeling of Germanness. You know, if I'm a merchant and I'm moving stuff across to another state, that's frictionless in a way that if there's tariffs and taxes, it's not. So it's moving that way.
Okay, I think the railways really add to that. If you can get your goods to the neighbouring state cheaply, efficiently, regularly, there does kind of expose what is the point of these borders.
Okay, well, on that exact point, so I suppose with the railways, it looks as if, from what I've heard there, that we have the movement of goods, but also we have the movement of ideas internally as well, which is something we can develop in our first sort of major question. The other aspect, though, is that isolation of Austria. So a theme we can return to later in terms of this Grossdeutsch or Big German solution.
Including Austria.
Exactly, including the Austrian empire with its many millions and its economic heft, but also, again, culturally, it's raising a profound question, like who are the German people and what could that look like as a political unit? Moving on now then, and building on, again, the progress that we've had identified there, particularly in terms of the economy or the connectedness in terms of the economy and its potential with the Zollverein, we can now think about a first major question, which is looking at the years 1848 to 1850. And what we really want to uncover here is, well, why did Germany not unify in that time? Why did they not actually manage to create a unified German state? I'd like to start off by looking at the Frankfurt Parliament. And I'd like to just uncover for our listeners what animated those who came together to form the Frankfurt Parliament. What were they trying to achieve? And then also, well, why did this project fail?
You asked a great question there. What were they trying to achieve? So we had these liberals, middle class lawyer types, clearly not representative of the whole German people, but represented sort of liberal progressive thought. They rocked up at this nice church in Frankfurt and chatted, talked among themselves. But what did they achieve? A talking shop. But they did not really have clear ideas. I think when they met up, it just exposed their differences. What are we going to, how can we define our country? It's not like the United Kingdom, which is made up of four parts, very clear, we're obviously two islands, very clear what our borders are. But Germany, the Austrians speak German, why can't they be in? But of course, the Austrian Empire, it's got a lot of non-Germans in it. Does Austria have to give up its empire to become part of Germany? Well, clearly, the Austrians won't want to do that. What power should presumably they'd have a constitutional monarchy, but what would how much power would that person have? Who would be the monarch? How would the princes, these dozens of princes, how would they be persuaded to stand down, to lose their own power, to give up power themselves? And it all comes down really to, you've mentioned it, the Grossdeutschland and the Kleindeutschland debate. What will the borders be? Are we going to be a Protestant northern Germany, or are we going to be a Protestant and Catholic whole Germany that we understand it today? Some very, very big questions which they did not reconcile, let alone all the problems that the French were having at this time, the French equivalent, where you've got the people, the less well-off, if you like, the people of the mob, are not being given what they want. So these people were just discussing lofty ideals of nationalism and liberalism, but the vast majority of the population were being forgotten by this debate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting we can point to why Germany is not unified in 48-50 as being based on those weaknesses and divisions that you're unpacking within the Frankfurt Parliament, but also the power of the conservative forces at the time, right? In 1848-49, nationalism is wrapped up with these liberal ideas, and that is something that is anathema or something that is really unwanted by the conservative forces. So the Austrians are going around and repressing revolutionaries in various parts of the Austrian Empire, in Prague, in Vienna, etc. Prussia, so in Berlin, Frederick William IV becomes the darling of 1848 when he comes out wrapped in the flag or wearing it and sort of aligning himself with liberals. But that's not what he actually thinks. It's sort of forced upon him. And by the time we get to 1849 and 1850 and the end of this, the conservative powers have reasserted themselves, and it is not in their interests to see a Germany that is unified. Princes in these different German states, they want to hold on to their power. Prussian ruler wants to hold on to his power. Austrian wants to hold on to their power. And so we don't have the agendas of nationalist ideals and conservatives aligning. And as long as that, or until that happens, there's always that huge barrier to unification.
They need someone to have those two values. I wonder if he will turn up at some point.
Maybe in a few years.
He may well turn up in a few years. But before we move on, 1850 is itself punctuated, not to overuse the term, by that agreement at Olmütz. Let's just explore that a little bit.
Shall I unpack that a little bit? Yeah. I think this is possibly, there are two moments in this time period where it looks like there could be some move towards unification. One is when the imperial crown of Germany is offered to Frederick William IV. And as you said in your introduction, he says, no, I don't want a crown that comes from the gutter. The second is the proposed Erfurt Union that comes from Prussia, where they get 26 states to basically meet up and begin to put together a constitution that will have some sort of togetherness to these states. But that's deeply and heavily opposed by Austria, who put pressure on states to reject this constitution. And it's eventually rejected by 14 of the 26 members say, no, we shouldn't have any sort of constitution that ties things together. And then come November 1850, that's sort of given up on. And I think those are the two ways in which some national identity or national union political body could have come out, but with both of those slapped down.
Absolutely. And really important just to say how deeply embarrassing this is for Prussia. This hugely exposes the lack of real power that Prussia have in the German sort of battle for supremacy. Let us now move on then to our second big question, which is, how did Bismarck bring about Austria's defeat of 1866? So here we need to navigate our way through, not simply thinking about what happened, the narrative, but how did Bismarck engineer Austrian isolation and then defeat?
Can I just start by slightly challenging the question? Because we have, how did Bismarck engineer the defeat? Well, he doesn't become minister president until 1862, so 4 years before the defeat. But a lot of the roots of this we can find before 1862. And actually, Bismarck finds himself on the side of the argument that is going in that direction, but he doesn't have perhaps the power that he will have later to allow that to happen. So if you go to the 1850s, there are a few things that happen that basically weaken Austria's position. That chimes with what Bismarck has been sort of advocating. He's been talking about allying with nationalists, excluding Austria. But you've also got external things like the Crimean War, which is going on in the mid-1850s, where Austria doesn't support Russia in that, and it sort of breaks down the Holy Alliance that they've got. And so we see sort of a beginning of a diplomatic isolation.
On that point, you also have quite a different approach, don't you? So you quite rightly reference Bismarck not being there in power until 1862. But who is the character who is before him, and the distinction there is quite significant, perhaps?
Mountaffel. If I pronounced that correctly. Yeah, I think Bismarck was a little bit lucky when he came to power. He had a sympathetic king, which we'll come on to, but also he had von Mountaffel had tidied up the Prussian bureaucracy, made the whole of the country much more efficient, tax collection, communication, all that sort of thing. He also built up the army. And the Prussian army, as we'll find out, was a very real force to be reckoned with. Also, he avoided confrontation with Austria. So he's not storing up problems. Despite the Crimean War and the Italian War of the 1850s, Prussia sort of kept itself aloof and sort of morally right, I suppose, put that that way, or and became a bit more of a player and a bit more sort of stronger. And I suppose, relatively speaking, it wasn't spending all this money fighting wars. It could spend that money on developing its country and be ready for Bismarck to take over.
So then what changes then with Bismarck? What does he actually bring in? What definite things happen with Bismarck that are distinctive?
Well, I think there's just one more thing that we actually need to talk about pre-Bismarck before we come to that question, which is furthering the military reforms that you're talking about with people like von Roon, and introduction of things like the needle gun and sort of technological developments that will underpin Prussian strength. You've got sort of the Krupp steelworks that are making breech-loading cannons and those sorts of things. So I think those paint the picture. But I think what Bismarck does, to come back to your question, Mr. Joy, that brings this, is he brings a real clarity of vision and a sort of hard-nosed approach to things. He talks about how the issues of the day will be decided by iron and blood, by Blut und Eisen, rather than speeches and majority. Like, and he has that sort of hard-headed, you referred to sort of realpolitik earlier, this sort of very pragmatic approach that says, no, actually, there is a clear goal. We see him being politically very astute. So there's issues over Schleswig and Holstein, which are the very northern part of Germany and on the border with Denmark, and it's sort of disputed who will own those territories.
Can we just navigate that then? So with regards to Schleswig-Holstein, what actually is going on there and what actually matters with that dispute?
Thank you, Mr. Joy. Wasn't it Palmerston who said no one can understand the Schleswig-Holstein crisis?
It was, but we will.
We will. We'll do our best.
We will.
thanks. So we've got, there was another Schleswig-Holstein crisis in 1848, which the Frankfurt Parliament failed to deal with, and it illustrates its lack of power. But this time, we've got the Danes wanting a bit of Schleswig, and this sort of rouse has sort of brought a more sort of nationalism. And actually, Bismarck collaborated with Austria to defeat Denmark in 1864, and they gave the Convention of Gastein gave Austria the southern one, Holstein, and Prussia administered the Schleswig, but Schleswig sort of princedom, but it is a temporary fix. This is not going to be a permanent thing. If you think where these places are in regard to where Austria is, it is not clear how this is a long-term solution.
Yeah, and I think those who feel like Bismarck has got the long-term vision, is planning out, you can point to something like the Convention of Gastein as something which he can, the sort of ambiguity and the fact that it's very temporary and the Austrians are involved in somewhere so far away from Austria and those sorts of things that he can use to provoke at the moment he wants to an issue. So potentially we're seeing some of his vision.
And diplomatic ability, quite extraordinary. You know, if you sort of, who was the best diplomat in the last 200 years, Bismarck would be right up there. And here, he's putting Austria in a difficult position. He then wins over Napoleon III extraordinarily at Biarritz, seems to convince him that he should be neutral in any war with Austria, which in the long term was France's very poor decision by a French leader, of course. And then he buys off the Italians as well. So and the Italians will now have will support Prussia in any war with Austria. So we've got Russia has been picked off or brought in as not an ally, but not a threat either. Remember, they bordered each other at this time by Austria's failure to support Russia during the Crimean War just 10 years earlier. Now we've got no French threat, no Italian threat. And in fact, Italy will back us up when we attack Austria. So and now it just needs the crisis where it will bring in a war. So Bismarck just needed a pretext. And that came with the breakdown in the Schleswig-Holstein Gastein agreement. And Prussia then said, right, Austria, you can't rule Holstein. We will do it better. Austria didn't accept this kind of embarrassing humiliation, really, for them. And they called for a federal mobilization. Prussia withdrew from the Confederation. And we now have a very short war of 7 weeks, all it took for Prussia to defeat the Austrians.
And that is an extraordinary moment. It feels like a defining moment. The Austrians, they could potentially mobilize a theoretical 600,000 men in terms of their army. And this is an almighty conflict. So we've already had reference, I think, to the needle gun, the Dresden needle gun, and the power that brings.
And also the railways and the mobilization. Yes. You sort of said there's up to 600,000 Austrians, but they're not able to get them to the battlefield, whereas the Prussian railways are much more efficient.
Exactly. So, so significant. So the economic development, the railway development, also the needle gun in terms of a five, you can fire five times quicker than the Austrian equivalent, which is a truly powerful weapon to have. When we think about the Battle of Sadowa, or Königgrätz, as it's also known in the German, which is in modern-day Poland, the outcome there, it's a bloody thing. Austria, they suffer 45,000 casualties. They've mobilized ultimately, as you were saying, Mr. Smith, around 350,000 out of a potential 600,000. And the Prussians there... The Prussians sustain, I say only with respect to life, but the Prussians losing their 9,000. So there's a clear sense of a very clear victory for the Prussians. But what is the value of the victory? How does that play out?
Well, it's interesting that Bismarck seeks not to completely destroy Austria. There is this discussion once Austria has been militarily defeated, what should we do? And Wilhelm the First is saying that we should go and march on Vienna. But Bismarck says, no, we need to go more carefully. We need to basically play the diplomatic game and make sure that Austria is not pushed towards these other players that Mr. Guttridge referred to earlier as being neutral, Russia and France. And so in that sense, I think this war shows Prussian military superiority, but it also shows a little bit of that sort of that diplomatic nous.
Yep.
That means that Prussia is able to kind of continue on this charge and not fall immediately into being surrounded by enemies in a way that would be damaging. Though it won't take him long to turn on France.
Of course. In terms of, that's a great point in terms of enemies, friends and enemies. What is happening there in terms of, again, the revivification, let's say, of the North German Confederation, the other states in Germany. What's happening? Is there a binding? Is there a coalescence? Or are things still quite fragmented?
Yeah, so the North German Confederation is formed in July 1867. So it's straight after this conflict that's been won, and it's North German states coming together in a sort of federal form. It's much tighter perhaps than the German Confederation that was formed in 1815, but it's all states north of the River Main. There's not a formal constitution. It's not a state with a president and that sort of thing. But it's a far more powerful political force, bound by alliances and things like that than we have seen previously. And some of the big states of the south are excluded from that, like Bavaria, Württemberg, etc. But there is a sort of secret agreement here where even those have secret agreements with Prussia that in wartime, if it's needed, they will contribute troops and under Prussian leadership and command. So very much we've had that transition to, look, Prussia is by far and away the dominant German power after the defeat of Austria.
Absolutely. And on the subject of transition, we also see here something that crystallizes and is shifting, which is extraordinary and really important, I think, analytically, which is the Prussian elections. They are very cleverly timed to coincide precisely with the victory at Sadowa or Königgrätz, where the conservative representation surges from 34 seats to 142, which is a crushing victory, and the liberal representation falls off a cliff edge. It goes from 253 to 148. And this is the fusion then of conservatism with the Prussian project. I would urge caution on getting too excited about, conservatism being fused to nationalism. But when we see Prussia First as a strategy or as an approach here, this is something that certainly the Junkers and those with landed interest...
Of whom Bismarck is
of
one.
Of whom Bismarck is, of course, very much one. We see that sort of alliance forming, crystallizing. And it's a new thing, and it's a powerful thing. So a theme we might return to later. Okay. So moving forward then, we can now start to address the extremely significant and dramatic area, which is Bismarck bringing about France's defeat of 1870. Again, the framing here perhaps could be more careful. We have the Franco-Prussian War. So I think as a first point here, could we just explore how important was the Ems telegram and Bismarck's role in that in terms of moving towards or provoking war?
Yeah, so the master strategist, Bismarck, master diplomat, was able to create a situation where Prussia or the North German Confederation was particularly strong after the defeat of Austria and box the French leader, Napoleon III, and the country into a corner where France was deemed to be the aggressor rather than Bismarck. And so we've got the Luxembourg crisis and just the, was it promised to, did Bismarck promise it to France? Did it, and it all not? And it all came out very publicly and excited German nationalists to stand up to the bully of Napoleon III. And then we've then got poor old France being surrounded by Prussian monarchs, potentially, with the Hohenzollern-Candidature crisis. And then we've got the most extraordinary case of all, perhaps, wouldn't want to make a political point, but fake news and all of that, with the Ems telegram. Bismarck himself changed a telegram from his king to the French ambassador to make it more confrontational. This wound up the nationalists in both France and Germany, and perhaps France had no choice but to declare war on an aggressive, as they saw it, Prussia. And so now, as Thier the said, it was France, not Austria, who was defeated at Sadowa, and this is almost like another battle of that German war of unification, was the defeat of France. It took a lot longer, almost a year this time, but France was roundly defeated at the Battle of Sedan, and even the Napoleon III was captured at that battle to show how much of a rout it was.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's interesting if we look at the Ems telegram and its role in that, provoking this tension and this mutual blame and inflaming tension. It's interesting that France has felt, I guess, since 1866, a little bit miffed by the changes that have been going on. You know, they've not gained any territory despite their interests in sort of Northern Italy and places like that and Luxembourg. And yet Prussia is growing. We've got this sort of expansionist element, and there is this sense that actually they are under pressure, and there is a need, as this Hohenzollern candidature comes along, that, you know, if you have a Hohenzollern in Spain on France's western border, you've got the Hohenzollerns on the east, Prussia on the eastern border, you've got this sense that they feel driven to it, even though we see the speed of their defeat. Clearly, the war was not a good option for them.
Yeah, you certainly get that sense that when you adopt a French lens, this idea of being surrounded and being outplayed, being manipulated, is pretty strong. It's hard to argue against, arguably.
And that comes across, too, in the sort of consequences of the Franco-Prussian War. If you look at it from a French lens, there is, we look at it and go, oh, the unification of Germany, but it's rank humiliation for the French. You know, the German state is, or the German Empire is declared in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles, which is the centerpiece of the French monarchy. We've got territories that have been French, Alsace-Lorraine, being taken away from them. It's not a defeat by Prussia like it was of Austria, where we saw magnanimous, let's not march on Vienna, let's go to Paris, let's rub it in their face, let's take their territory. It's a very different sort of defeat for
it
the
is.
French.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like Moltke gave the warning after the victory of Sedan. He said, what we've gained by arms in half a year, we must protect by arms for half a century. And then if you think about the First World War and then the German delegation being brought back to the Palace of Versailles and the Hall of Mirrors to have to sign that humiliating peace, the Treaty of Versailles, in that very place. There's huge significance for that.
And huge monetary terms at both treaties as well, right? We talk about 6.6 billion pounds at the Treaty of Versailles, but we're talking 5 billion francs here that, that France has to pay through the Peace of Frankfurt. So, yeah, it is punishment.
It is indeed. One thing we could explore before we move on to our final consideration for today might be this hugely significant, moment where there's a particular title that is taken, adopted by the King of Prussia. Why does it matter? Why do they get so animated by how the King of Prussia, who becomes the head of this new state, why does it matter? Why do they get so animated about it?
It's very revealing, I think, illustrates quite a lot. Is this a greater Prussia that's being created? Is this a Prussian takeover of Germany? Or is it a mutually beneficial collection of like-minded states working together to get the best out of it? And by Wilhelm I proclaiming himself the emperor who happens to be German, rather than the emperor of the German people, I'm the boss of all of you, at Versailles, it illustrates this deliberate distinction between Prussian leadership and state autonomy. And Germany today is a very federal country with very proud state loyalties. So there is this localized loyalties is very pronounced in Germany.
Indeed. But there can be no doubt about Prussian leadership. And of course, Bismarck himself becomes the Chancellor of this newly formed German Empire.
And Berlin the capital.
So, and this now takes us organically to our final consideration. So how far was Bismarck responsible for the unification then of Germany? What do we think? Did he make Germany? Did Germany make Bismarck? Is this too simplistic? Was it inevitable? Not inevitable?
I think Bismarck is playing a huge role. I think he is capitalizing on the developments of Prussia, on the diplomatic situation. You know, he is navigating the ship of Prussian diplomacy, the Prussian state, in an expert way. Yes, he is probably going with the current of the river as he's piloting this boat. But, you know, there are rapids there. There are rocks that the boat could founder upon. And he is guiding that in a hugely strategic, intelligent way. His realpolitik, his diplomatic isolation of France, you know, they're not self-evident and obvious. Sorry, isolation of Austria. They're not self-evident options for him. They are chances that he takes advantage of and manufactures. And so isolating Denmark, then Austria, then France, you know, that is the fact that you see his fingerprints all over this unification project.
I disagree. I think it he was a lucky man in the right place at the right time. He was this great man theory of history is a little bit old hat, and it is he was just Germany was going to unify at one point. The economic power of it, the nationalism, the mass feeling by the 1860s of we're in this together will be. It wasn't made unity inevitable. It needed, I guess, someone to facilitate it, I suppose. But if it wasn't Bismarck, it could have been someone else. The king was, Wilhelm I, was very sympathetic to it as well. And so I have no doubt that it would have come about maybe a few years later, possibly without all those thousands dead on the battlefields. But Germany was going to be united, if not just for economic reasons and sort of Austria's failings, it was going to be a greater Prussia at some point.
No, I think it's interesting that before Bismarck comes on the scene, the best or the most cohesive German things we see are not political. They are economic. And I think there's a real distinction
ideology.
Between... Well, Yes, but I think that is so ephemeral. It's important. It's a prerequisite for these developments, but they're economic. He transforms it through military power into something that can have a political element. You know, there's a reason we don't see the German Empire as it becomes from 1871 is a political unit as opposed to a economic unit in the way that, say, the European Union has been through the last 40, 50 years. You know, there's a real distinction. I think Bismarck is critical in making that a political manifestation rather than a notional liberal or nationalistic idea or a solely economic element.
I think there is a middle ground which we can occupy.
No, can we not? Just stay on our...
Well, firstly, I would say that... And I have to confess that I'm a fan of Christopher Clark as a historian. I like the fact that he sort of critically deconstructed this almost myth of Bismarck being in total control of events. And I think that's appropriate historically. So the idea that Bismarck's plans were totally sort of in total control, that he was meticulous, I think that's a bit of a nonsense and exaggerated. However, in the mix, again, if we think about the French role in here, and again, overconfidence in their own military capacity, Napoleon III, of course, the very term militarism is coming from Napoleon III. So he is rather obsessed and perhaps overblown in his own kind of view of his own capabilities there. But in terms of the middle ground, so from 1862, when Bismarck has that position of authority, we have a broad strategic vision, which you've just referenced there, Mr. Smith. But tactically, he's flexible and he capitalizes intelligently on circumstances that he engineered. But also, he is lucky, he's fortunate in a sense as well. The fact that it took three wars that he provokes to do this is deeply unfortunate and nothing to celebrate. However, I think ultimately we can say with confidence that Bismarck's vision is a very strong and powerful one. There is still some internal autonomy within the workings of the constitution, but real power with the emperor and his military and then his appointed ministers, including members of a military cabinet. That gives great, great power, and it brings stability to Europe, of course, until, as we know from our other course, Bismarck is dismissed by Kaiser Wilhelm II, and then that takes us to a period of instability and ultimately the First World War. So the final thing perhaps to think about is that, as Bismarck himself would say, to understand this period, you have to understand Prussia's particular interests.
If I can come back, I would say the ease with which those northern German states sort of toppled to Prussian leadership suggests to me it just needed someone just to flick the first domino and it would all come. And now that didn't need to be Bismarck. That was inevitable. That would come. So I disagree that it was Bismarck. It was all about him.
Which is, you know, an opinion.
The debate will rumble on.
It will.
And on. Whatever view we take of Bismarck, the unification of Germany was the single most transformative event in 19th century European diplomacy. And Bismarck's removal from office also laid the foundations for a far less stable Europe and one that moved Europe towards war.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Oh, farewell.
Thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next time.